and welcome to New Books in Religion. I'm your co-host, Hilary Kale. With roots in a workshop at the University of Copenhagen in 2012, Emotions and Christian Missions brings together scholars from Australia, New Zealand, Canada, England, the US, Germany, and Denmark. Through a set of wide-ranging essays, the authors collectively tackle a major question: how were emotions conceptualized and practiced in Christian missions from the 17th to the 20th centuries? Case studies take up sites in North America, the Philippines, India, China, Congo, in order to show how emotional practices such as prayer, tears, shouting, and feelings of joy or frustration shaped relationships between missionaries, prospective converts, and supporters at home. I'm pleased to welcome one of the volume's editors, Claire McCliskey, to NBIR. She joins us from New South Wales, where she is a research fellow at Griffith University in Brisbane. Hello and welcome.
Thank you, Hilary.
My first question for you is, how did the idea of this book and the conference that preceded it come about?
Well, I was working at Copenhagen University at the time, and I got to know a colleague called Karen Valgorda, who became my co-editor, and she was the first person I'd ever met who was working on Christian missions and missionaries, but also really interested in the theory of emotions and in particular how missionaries practiced and expressed emotions and also attempted to use emotions in their work. So we had many fruitful conversations, and when I was awarded my postdoc in 2012, the first thing I wanted to do was get together some other scholars in the area so that we could sort of sit down and really try to get a broad idea of how this might have played out across geographical and chronological borders. So we did that, and Daniel Medina, who was a postgraduate student at the time at Copenhagen University, attended that workshop because he was actually working on some sources that were very interesting, and so he became involved in editing as well.
I realize that you do a lot of things, but this is New Books in Religion. So I was wondering if you could step back a bit and give us a sense of how you came to study, you yourself, the history of religion specifically.
Yeah, that's a great question. I was really interested when I started to think about what sort of PhD I'd like to write, and this is back in 2004, I was really interested in the multiple ways in which relationships played out on colonial frontiers, specifically in Australia, which is where I come from and also where I was about to start my PhD. And initially I wanted to look at different case studies. I thought I'd look at a protector of Aborigines, so sort of official governmental figure. I'd look at a squatter. I'd look at a missionary, and I'd look at several other figures. When I got to the missionary archives, and this was I was working on the Maloga Mission in New South Wales in the late 19th century, I was just overwhelmed. There was so much material there, and so much more than I had been able to find on any of the other figures I'd been looking at. And I think I had a family connection as well. My grandmother was very religious, and that affected our whole family and made me very curious about what attracted people to, I guess, not just the sort of everyday practices of religion, but actually changing your life and moving countries for a belief. So I was attracted probably because I had that family history, but also because the archives were just so rich in possibilities that I thought I'd be able to answer lots of my questions, which I couldn't necessarily answer in some of the other colonial archives.
And so when you started that project, were you already interested in the history of emotions, or was that something that came later?
That came later. It really arose out of the archives. And this particular couple who ran Maloga Mission for 14 years, they had a series of love letters that they'd written to each other before they started the mission, 118 letters that have survived, so there were probably more, that they wrote in a six-month period, and that was where they really negotiated their future relationship and, in fact, the role that the mission would play in it, because it was a deal-breaker for the woman, Janet Matthews. She didn't want to marry Daniel unless he would commit to starting a mission with her.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I thought you were going to say the opposite, that she was really, she was not sure that that's where she wanted to go.
No, that was his feeling. But it was very interesting because, of course, they talked about their feelings, their emotions for each other, for the Aboriginal people that they both, I mean, he knew them well because he lived on the frontier. She didn't, but she imagined them in a certain way, and she imagined that she had this very strong love for them, or she did feel this love for them, which she thought was enough of a motivation to devote her life to them and Daniel's life because, of course, he wanted to marry her. So he in fact, agreed to becoming a missionary, setting up a mission with her, and that was sort of through his love for her. So from then on in, I was very sensitive to questions about emotion because I realized that there was a lot more going on here than I'd realized.
Yeah, what power there, you know? Then the next time that I ask my partner to take out the trash and he tells me I'm asking too much, I'll say, well, let me tell you what I could be asking. Could send you to Australia to do a mission. What can you tell us a little bit actually about that mission that they started? I mean, what religious background? They're Christians, but what background were they coming from? What period are you talking about here?
Yes, so the mission was founded in 1874, and they were quite unconventional at the time in Australia, but I think also globally, because they weren't attached to a mission society. They were two individuals from different denominations. So Janet had been brought up a Baptist, but her father was a missionary to seamen, and he'd founded the Seamen's Mission in Sandridge in Melbourne. And he ran an ecumenical mission. So although she was Baptist, she had this very ecumenical approach from her father. And Daniel Matthews, her husband, was a Methodist, and he'd been brought up he's from Cornwall and emigrated as a child, as Janet had. They both emigrated to Australia as children. And he'd also been brought up in this very particular environment in colonial Victoria where, in fact, a lot of these nonconformist denominations were having to work together. So he was part of the Band of Hope, and he ran Sunday schools. And so they both had this ecumenical emphasis, which meant that when they set up their mission, they set it up in an ecumenical fashion. So they did not attach themselves to any particular church or any particular mission society, and rather they relied on private donations to fund their mission.
As you were saying, I mean, there's this emotional attachment that they feel both to each other and to the Aboriginal people, at least an imagined emotional attachment, certainly, even before they've met them. Maybe you can help our listeners who are not familiar with the study of emotion get a better sense of it. What is the study of emotion? How does one define it, if possible? And how does one do it? How does one study emotion?
Those are very good questions. So what is the study of emotion? I guess for those of us lucky enough to have texts which are rich in emotives, which is a term that a theorist called William Reddy has come up with, which he means he uses to describe emotion words. So words that have to do with emotion, they might be words like love, hate, anger. But there are other words that are associated with emotion as well, which are more subtle. So if you have sources that are rich in this sort of language, then really part of the work that we do is a very close reading to attempt to see how historical actors are using these terms, what they mean by them. A very important part of the history of emotions is trying to trace the shifts in meaning of different emotions over time. So we can't assume from the 21st century perspective that the word love had the same connotations in the late 19th century as it has now. And in fact, for the missionaries I have worked on, usually they're talking about Christian love. They're talking about a very specific formation of love, which isn't often referred to outside Christian or missionary circles today. So you have to be very careful and sensitive to how historical actors are using these terms. So we do close readings of texts. We attempt to contextualize these emotion words or emotives through research into how different the theorists or often etiquette guides are used because they often talk about behavior and how you should and should not behave and which emotions you should display and which not. But in the case of missionaries, it's often more the sorts of religious tracts which describe the appropriate behaviors that can be useful. Also, some people are lucky enough if they're looking at a missionary society, then there are missionary training manuals which also might describe these things. So it's really about putting these in context. What are emotions? That's a very, very big question. There's some recent work by Monique Scheer, who builds on Pierre Bourdieu's practice theory, and she likes to think about emotions as practices. So they're not just things that happen inside you, but rather they're things that are cultivated over time. So we learn to understand and experience emotions through the ways that we think and act and talk and the practices that we have around emotions that are built up over time. It's a very difficult question. I mean, there are lots of different definitions of emotion. Yeah. And we haven't tried to define emotion as such ourselves in the introduction to the book that we've just edited, because we thought, in fact, all of the authors are coming at it from slightly different perspectives, so we let them develop their own theories or definitions.
Right, but that deep context that you were talking about before is clearly associated with that, because you might have different notions of what emotion constitutes or what those practices constitute depending on which site each of the authors in the book is working on.
That's quite right, and I think that's really important that these things are historically specific, the way we understand our emotions, and not just historically, but as you say, geographically and culturally specific. So, and even language, you know, language has enormous effect. William Reedy, again, has done a lot of work on how, in fact, the act of verbalizing an emotion can change the way we experience that emotion, solidify it, you know, kind of limit it to some extent, but also make it more sort of rigid, or you know, that suddenly it's encapsulated in a word. And so when you say, "I hate you," suddenly that feeling may change within you because of the act of saying it. So it's really important to think about, well, different languages have different words for emotion. Different cultures obviously have different ideas about what sort of emotions exist, let alone what sort of emotions should be expressed in different circumstances. So really, these things are very specific, and I think, yeah, providing that context and leaving your definition maybe quite open and seeing then what your sources can tell you and whether it's appropriate to talk about emotional practices or emotional styles, emotional regimes. There are many different theories that have been proposed. So it's really, I think, I like to be led by the archives and led by the historical context in terms of how I theorize.
I noticed from your introduction, and you just brought this up as well, that you know, you don't impose a definition of emotion on all of the chapters, that offers emotion as one kind of construct. So I was curious on that note whether you found that the authors, given how many backgrounds the scholars come from, how many places, mm-hmm. did you find that as you came around the table, as it were, you were bringing quite similar kinds of assumptions or ways of thinking? Or was there a regional difference in terms of your approaches, in terms of the various things that scholars who are working in, for example, German or Danish are bringing that differ from the Anglo and Anglo-American scholars?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Unfortunately, not all of the people who have ended up in the collection were around the table. So it's a metaphorical table when I start to talk now about differences. And then also, unfortunately, not all of the people who were at the symposium sort of were able to contribute or ended up being included in the final collection. So I can say from what happened at the symposium that it was sort of a combination of trends. One was that those of us who had read a lot of the same theories and the literature on the history of emotion that's been developing over the last 20 years, I think we were all drawing from a similar body of ideas. And that's not to say that there was consensus, because there is really no consensus in the literature, but I think we all had a common understanding. And what was interesting and wonderful then were the people who hadn't been so well grounded in that literature were coming with often ideas which were much more shaped by the work that they'd been doing and the long engagement that they had in their specific fields. And so I think maybe that was more of a distinction between those of us who'd enmeshed ourselves in theory and the others who were coming from a more sort of archival basis. But I do think that, yes, generally I would say that there's a tendency in the Anglo and American world to, in Australia, I'd include in this as well, to draw on a specific set of theorists. And, for example, in Germany, they have quite a different canon of often German philosophers and theorists who they might be drawing on in addition to or instead of. And that's a wonderful kind of cross-pollination when you bring those two groups together. And I mean, I have to say, we didn't have Maria Cecilia Holt at the symposium as such, but I have met her now in person at a more recent conference I organised, and she's coming from a theological background and the richness that that brings, because it's a whole different body of work, often again on emotions, but not something that all of us were familiar with. So, yeah, I think in a way it's more where our brains have been in terms of the theories we've been reading, the archives we've been immersed in, than necessarily our own cultural backgrounds.
Right, yeah. Were there the metaphorical table, were there, as you were gathered around the table also, were there discussions about the kinds of challenges, maybe some pitfalls to studying emotion?
Definitely. And I think even those of us who've been doing it for a while and would maybe call ourselves historians of emotion, we recognise that there are pitfalls too. But perhaps that's also, I mean, this is a thing in the field of historical inquiry, there are always unknowns. So one common kind of concern about the study of emotions is that emotions are somehow more ephemeral, harder to kind of pin down than other historical kind of influences or forces, and how can we ever know what someone actually felt? And so this was something that came up at the symposium. But, of course, all we have is the record of those feelings, whether it's a person's own description, somebody else's description, in words or perhaps pictorial depictions of faces, of bodies expressing emotions or affect in different ways. And that's really all we have in the historical record anyway, of thoughts, of theories, of actions. It's all we have descriptions. So working from that basis, I think for those at the symposium who hadn't looked much at emotions before and who were maybe a little bit worried that they had gone out on a limb because it seemed to them that emotions were less reliable somehow than other historical phenomena. I think as during the process of discussion and then editing and review, I think people became a lot more confident, those who weren't sort of maybe so confident to begin with, actually developed their certainties around the fact that this in fact was a valid area of inquiry. And of course some of the people in the collection have been working on this for a long time and so didn't have those concerns, even though of course I think we all recognize that there are limits to what we can say about how historical actors felt in the past, but we can certainly talk about how they wrote and how they described their own and others' emotions.
Maybe rather than talking about challenges, we could talk about some of the things that the study of emotion then brings. I mean, what does it bring to the history of missions that has previously been overlooked?
Well, that was something that we wanted to look at in a holistic sense, because of course we all have our own case studies which we think, okay, well this really shows a new aspect of, say, the particular dynamics in colonial Australia, that just looking at at missions in maybe more traditional social history, cultural history, maybe even religious history ways, you know, wouldn't bring up. But when we all got together, we sort of were really excited because we thought we might be able to sort of extend our insight into what emotions could bring. And I think one of the things that really became evident as we all kind of presented our different case studies was just the wonderful kind of ways in which looking at emotion can open up interpersonal relations and allow us to do more of what we've already been trying to do through social history, through cultural history, and you know, it's sort of a history from below, where we're trying to not just look at what the great figures of history, in some cases, in some depictions of mission history, this would be the missionaries, that not what just what they set out to do, but actually what happened on the ground and how they had to negotiate, how they were often frustrated, how Indigenous peoples or the peoples they set out to convert, had a lot of room to negotiate to different extents in different contexts, and how they could use sometimes, you know, they didn't have much political power, they didn't have much physical power, but within the realm of emotions, within the realm of interpersonal relations, sometimes there is the ability. There's the ability to withhold affection, to withhold love, to, you know, negotiate on that level. And I think that really is quite exciting because it provides another way in which we can kind of unpack what are often quite formulaic descriptions of mission life that you would find in mission reports or even missionary letters. You know, they're really genres, these types of writing. So I think by paying attention to emotions, you can start to look more carefully at those aspects.
Without asking you to speak on behalf of your colleagues, but could you give us maybe a couple examples from the book that strike you in terms of what we've just been talking about, the history of emotions can add to the study of, in this case, missions?
Sure. Well, in Elizabeth Elborn's wonderful chapter on the relationship between John Strachan, an Anglican clergyman in Upper Canada, and a Mohawk man named Thayendanegea, or Joseph Brant, as he was known to the British, Elizabeth Elborn, I think, really shows the importance of the emotion of frustration within this relationship. And because the texts which were produced by both the missionary and Joseph Brant, his convert, are so sort of, that they've really come to be very influential and taken as sort of evidence of particular trends in the history of mission in Upper Canada. I think what she really does is shows how by looking at the emotions that underlay these texts that motivated them and that influenced the ways, for example, that John Strachan portrayed Joseph Brant after he had sort of rejected Strachan, really give us a much more nuanced view of what these texts are doing. So I guess really helping us to question sort of accepted versions of history, which often have been defined by the missionaries, although in this case Joseph Brant himself also wrote a book which you know, became influential, but really just helping us to complicate our idea of how these interactions took place. And of course, you know, a lot of these missionaries, they sacrificed enormous amounts, their own lives, their own resources in order to pursue their mission. But at the same time, you can see within that ideal of noble sacrifice, when it did not achieve the goals that that they hoped it would, there's an enormous potential there for exasperation, for despair, for melancholy, as another author in the collection explores, and that these emotions were in fact just as important as the kind of more more noble emotions such as love and hope and compassion that the missionaries perhaps preferred to write about themselves.
So maybe you could give listeners a sense of what you wrote about, because you have this fantastic chapter with the stories of Burong and Papa, two young people who, you know, you're talking before about this idea of soft power. You didn't use that term, but sort of the kind of power that missionized people might be able to assert by withholding certain kinds of emotions. And I think Burong and Papa are good examples of that. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about them and how emotion plays into the relationship between them and the missionaries who made contact with them.
Sure. So Burong and Papa are two sort of teenage individuals who were both approached by missionaries, or in the case of Papa, it's the missionary Hans Ehle in Greenland, Danish missionary in the early 18th century, claims that, in fact, Papa approached him. So anyway, there are these two young people who make contact with missionaries and both end up living with the missionaries for a period and becoming helpers to them. Papa was 12 when he made contact with Hans Ehle, the Danish missionary, and Burong was 15 when she made contact with Richard Johnson, who was the first Anglican chaplain to Australia. And although he didn't call himself a missionary, he in fact behaved often as if he was one. He was very interested in going beyond his remit of being chaplain to the convicts and the soldiers, and in fact making contact with Aboriginal people and trying to teach them about the gospel. So both of these young people, I think, really negotiated their relationships with the missionaries in quite interesting ways. You can see there's so many power differentials, which would suggest that these young people really didn't have much room to move. So they're a lot younger than the missionaries. They are in colonial situations where, although it's very, very early on for both of them, so these are the first missionaries to Australia and Greenland, respectively, but it's already become apparent that, that the colonisers, the British and the Danish, have superior firepower, that they have superior sort of technology, and that things are going to be difficult for the Indigenous people who are living in that area. But in both cases, I think there's a real sense in which, in the archival descriptions of Burong and Papa's behaviour, they actually managed to sort of stake their own claims and influence proceedings, at least in part, in order to get what they want out of the situation, really. And for Papa, that seems to be knowledge. He's really interested in learning about Christianity and learning about European ideas and technology, and he actually converts to Christianity quite early on, and becomes a helper to the mission, and is up until his death in a smallpox epidemic 6 years later. Burong, on the other hand, this young Aboriginal woman, Gamaragal woman in Sydney, she seems to be much more interested in her role as a negotiator between her own people and the Europeans. And she's not the only person fulfilling this role in early colonial Sydney, but she's certainly, Richard Johnson says that, you know, he's managing to make progress with her in teaching her to write and read and teaching her the gospel. But through her actions, in fact, Burong shows later that although perhaps she did have some connection with Richard Johnson, and there seems to be an affection there, she lives with him and his wife, but in fact her deeper loyalties are to her own people, and she ends up leaving the Johnsons and going back to her own people, and in that way refusing the emotional investment that Johnson had made in her, and the hopes that Johnson and the other colonists had that she would somehow provide a bridge between the two cultures and allow them to have a sort of conciliation, as they called it, where they would feel that they had come to their position of power in this colonial society in a sort of a just way, whereas, in fact, the Aboriginal people were not about to give up their land so easily. And so, in fact, what resulted was a lot of conflict and violence. But I think it's very interesting to compare these two, because while Papa embraces Christianity, the missionary, the mission, and becomes a missionary to his own people, and Burong refuses ultimately the mission, the missionary, Christianity, and returns to her own people, there are, in fact, I think, a lot of similarities in the way that these young people start to negotiate their positions.
You were talking earlier about the importance of historically contextualizing these emotions and not assuming that emotions that we understand in the 21st century were the same for these historical actors. And there's this moment that I found so fascinating when you're describing Burong, which is where Richard Johnson says, "She's happy." And you unpack that idea of happiness. Could you tell us a little more historically, what would it mean to say that Burong was happy in this period?
Well, that's a really good question, because the idea of happiness, that the word happy itself was undergoing changes at that time in the late 18th century and sort of throughout the medieval period. So there's a great article on this topic by Darren McMahon, which he calls "From the Happiness of Virtue to the Virtue of Happiness." He was really looking at the way in which from ancient Greeks onwards and right up through the medieval period, happiness was really thought of as a byproduct or the end goal that would result from a virtuous life. So in ancient Greece, this was associated with Greek virtues or the Greek ideas about virtue, but in the Christian tradition then became associated with ideas about Christian virtue, so that being happy was something that you might experience. I mean, most likely in the afterlife, if you had lived a virtuous life on earth, then you might aspire to happiness in the afterlife. As the sort of 16th and 17th century progressed, these ideas started to become believed that it was in fact more possible to experience happiness on earth, but still this was the result of virtue. This was still something that, you know, if you were a good and kind person, that in fact you might be described as happy. Later though, during the Enlightenment, ideas about happiness were really put through the same sort of analytical, I guess, under the same scrutiny as many other religious ideas, and there was this separation of the idea of happiness from the idea of religious virtue. So around the time when Richard Johnson is writing about Burong being happy, you have this move inspired by John Locke and other philosophers who had in fact begun to think of happiness as something that could be experienced by humans regardless of virtue, so that they weren't just happy because they were good, but in fact they could be happy just by virtue of perhaps being lucky. This was another association, or in fact that this was sort of an emotional state that was unconnected to inner virtue. So when this colonist Bradley, who described Burong as happy, but Richard Johnson also at different times talks about happiness. This is the question I had: well, what did they actually mean? Were they implying that she was in some way virtuous? She had certainly been a great help to the colonists. She had in fact, as Johnson wrote, you know, she displayed some interest in learning to read and write and learning about the gospel. So was it a description of her as virtuous? Was it a description of her perhaps as lucky? Because, I mean, certainly some of these colonists did believe that they were bringing civilization, religion to the Aboriginal people of Australia, and that the Aboriginal people of Australia should be grateful for this, and that they were perhaps, you know, lucky in that sense, that they had this opportunity to learn about European civilization. Or was this in fact just a more modern version of the word happy, in the way that we think of happiness, that they just thought that Burong was in fact independently experiencing an emotion. And in fact, this description was when she was with her people, and was this in fact a description of just her her delight to be with her people. So because they were so interested in whether Buron could communicate European values and European ideas to her people, this was a really important moment, because they were sort of trying to work out, is she happy in the sense that she's providing a model of how an Aboriginal person might feel when exposed to the gospel, when exposed to Christianity, and communicating that to her country people in order to help them to learn about and embrace this new religion, or was this in fact just a happiness that perhaps was more due to luck as they saw it, or in fact an internal state that she experienced being with her people? So I don't think I necessarily answered that. I think I actually came to the conclusion that they probably were thinking of all of those things. They were hoping that she might be going to communicate something of the benefits of what they saw of the benefits of European contact to her people, but that they probably were also aware of these other meanings of happy. And as it turned out, you know, she chose to go back to her people and back to her culture. And I think if we can say that Buron was happy in any way, then probably we as modern readers would say that she was probably happy just to be back with her own.
You talk also in your chapter, but also in the introduction, about this notion of circuits, effective circuits, which is this great term. And you're drawing loosely on, or emotional circuits, you're drawing loosely on other work on affect. Can you give us a sense of what that means, how emotions circulate in the sense that you're thinking with, for example, the cases of Papa and Burong or other cases in the book?
I mean, I came to this idea of affective circuits in part through the work of Sarah Ahmed, who has written about emotional circuits, affective circuits, and she really sees emotions not as something that sort of exists in one person or well up in one person, but that they're relational, that it's always emotion is always moving between, she says, people and other people, people and objects, and that emotions have to do with the way we orient ourselves to the outside world. Even the idea of something or someone else that's in our head, obviously it can be enough, but that emotions are moving, and she looks at the etymology of the word to show that the idea of motion is in fact part of the idea of emotion. So by thinking about circuits, I wanted to sort of extend this analysis to think about the ways in which, and I guess it's certainly something that other theorists have looked at too, but the ways in which emotions can operate in a circular way, both within ourselves, so that there can be what you might call a feedback loop, that by experiencing an emotion, by verbalizing that emotion, by expressing it to others or not, but that act of recognizing and naming an emotion can intensify the experience of the emotion within an individual. And this is something that that Bourdieu again has written about in terms of affective circuits, such as sort of the intensification of an emotion through perhaps the act of crying, or through the act of smiling, that we can kind of start off a feedback loop. This is also something that, of course, happens between people, so between individuals. If you see someone else crying, such as in my paper when I write about Papa at his conversion, and the missionary Hanziel describes him crying tears of joy and devotion, which then elicit tears of joy and devotion in the audience who are present, because they are moved by his emotion. And the question of whether that emotion comes back to the originator is sort of, you can't always say, but I think the idea of intensification of emotion both within people and between people was quite useful, especially when I started to reflect on the fact that both these missionaries I was looking at seemed to be attempting to provoke this very, to sort of kickstart this sort of circuit in their converts. And I wondered whether, in fact, this this was a sort of technique, you might say, that in fact emotion was so useful because it did have this potential to kind of both transfer between individuals, but also to kind of intensify a sense of feeling and they hoped a sense of belief, which of course for evangelical Christians of the 18th and 19th centuries, you know, belief was very much linked to feeling. And I think that's probably still true to say of evangelical Christianity. It's a very important part of an individual's connection with God is that felt aspect.
The book really looks at a lot of different kinds of Christians. I mean, evangelicals and that pietist kind of tradition are obvious ones perhaps, but there's Catholics, Anglicans, obviously Moravians, Presbyterians. In what sense did you find across the chapters that there were differences in terms of how religious emotion was conceived in these groups or even contested amongst them?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I should clarify, because I'm using evangelical in quite a specific way when I talk both in the book and now about evangelicals, and that's really the sort of very basic idea of an evangelical being anyone who wants to go out and proclaim the gospel. So it's not just, you know, the way that we often now talk about evangelicals in terms of specific denominations in the 21st century or even, of course, in the 19th century, you know, the small evangelical was often used for a sort of whole range of nonconformists and a big evangelical just for Anglican evangelicals, but when we talk in the book about evangelicals, we're really talking about anyone who goes out and evangelizes, who sees that as a core part of their belief. So on one hand, I would say that is something that links all of the denominations that we look at in the book. And you're right, there are many different, you know, Catholic, Protestant kind of what is usually a divide, and unfortunately we only have one chapter on Catholic missionaries, but still I thought it was really important that we did have at least one, both because there are very important denominational differences between how different groups conceive of emotion, but also because, in fact, when we're looking at missionaries who are sort of going out and motivated really by their beliefs and by their felt connection with those beliefs, they do have a lot in common. So, I mean, one good example of the differences is Monique Scheer's article, where she really writes about these German-American Methodists who sort of the German immigrants in America are affected and convert to Methodism through the big Methodist revivals in the US, then they go back to Germany and bring back this particular brand of Methodism, which, you know, is not viewed kindly by the Lutheran establishment, and in fact even by other Methodists in Germany. You know, there's real kind of tensions about the very emotional way or the very particular emotions that they use. They're shouting, that's right. And so this, of course, is an enormous cause for tension. And partly, I think, because, and this is something Monique really makes clear, and I think she's right, there's this real suspicion of emotion. And I think it's partly a sort of enlightenment development where the sort of this idea of a separation between rationality and emotionality, and that, you know, many of these pietist groups have this idea that you know, in fact, while the emotions are important, they need to be controlled in very particular ways, and you know, limits placed on how loud or overt particular emotions are expressed. That said, though, I have another article which compares the Moravian and the Lutheran missionaries in Greenland. And that was published in the Journal of Religious History, well, actually will be just in a few months now. But I was surprised to find that, I mean, the Moravians are renowned for being the most extreme, really, of all the denominations in terms of their emotional expression and their appeals to the sort of the blood and the tears of Jesus Christ and wanting to to curl up and live inside his side wound. And I mean, all these amazing statements, which Zinzendorf goes through sort of a period. This is the Moravian leader, a period of really embracing. But you can see the influence of this kind of approach to emotion for a long time afterwards, even though the Moravian Brotherhood sort of moves officially away from this rhetoric. But despite the fact that they're really renowned for this extreme emotional expression, and their converts too, and the Lutherans really criticized them in Greenland for, you know, spreading false doctrine and teaching the Greenlanders sort of all these emotional practices that they don't think are really appropriate. In fact, when you look at Hans Eel, as I did in that article, I've also done in this chapter in this book, he is using emotions, you know, extensively. His drawing in his descriptions on his own emotional experience. He's really interested in how the Greenlandic converts are experiencing emotion,
he's a Lutheran.
He's a Lutheran, yeah. So it's, even though he has a different emotional style and he's very critical of the Moravians, in fact, he's doing some very similar things in terms of how he uses emotion to the Moravians. So, yeah, I think that the differences are definitely important and need to be explored. You know, that's where comparative work is so useful, because you can actually get in and really look maybe at a similar geographical, chronological sort of setting and then see, well, within this, how do the different denominations work? But I guess I have been surprised again and again by the fact that really these missionaries are facing similar problems, and often emotions are a key to either helping to ameliorate the situation or sometimes really make it much worse. If the missionaries can't control or can't channel their own emotions into kind of constructive engagements with local peoples.
Speaking in a more general sense again, I suppose, I'm wondering if there's any other examples like happiness that we were just talking about, these Christian emotions or other emotions that are undergoing changes in this period, or that perhaps our 21st century listeners would recognize the words but actually would interpret them very differently.
Well, I think Maria Cecilia Holt's article on melancholy or acedia, which of course is a much older term, is very interesting in that way, because I think if we think of melancholy today as being, you know, a sense of sadness, a sense of longing, something that's very individual, very personal, but not necessarily spiritual. But the 17th century Augustinian who she looks at, Saint Augustine, and then the Jesuit who then kind of attempts to rehabilitate, I guess, Augustine's reputation. When they're writing about melancholy, they're really writing about it in this quite specific spiritual way, and they're drawing on this much earlier notion of acedia, which is a kind of a spiritual despair, a deep, I think it's the noonday demon who comes to tempt men and, you know, away from God and into this kind of apathy and despair. So Maria's chapter is wonderful because when she writes about Juan José Delgado, this 18th century Jesuit missionary attempting to sort of rehabilitate the reputation of San Agustin, she shows how this wasn't just a kind of personal sense of compassion that Delgado might have had for Agustin, that, you know, well, he suffered from melancholy, therefore we can exclude him. Oh, sorry, we can excuse him. You know, his sort of awful diatribe against the Filipinos. But rather, this is a spiritual condition. This is a very grave kind of spiritual condition of acedia or melancholy that, in fact, is an example of really the dangers that and the pitfalls of mission work for missionaries. And you know, really, I mean, he makes it into a much broader concern that, in fact, we all need to, he says, you know, be concerned about this. And of course, I mean, he's right. This is something that, in colonial situations where missionaries are facing all sorts of challenges to their own faith, to their authority, and all sorts of difficulties, that in fact this is something that the missionary societies and churches should be focusing on. And I think the way that Holt sort of identifies this as not just a kind of emotion that one individual feels, but part of a much broader colonial malaise, and something that in fact at least some within the church recognised as being very serious, and a connection there between the colonial context and the difficulties faced by missionaries is made really explicit. You know, there are many examples of missionaries criticising colonial authorities, but I think this is a wonderful one because it focuses specifically on the emotions that being in this difficult situation might evoke. And so, I mean, while I think it's easy for a modern reader to empathise through Holt's analysis and through Delgado's rehabilitation of Augustine, adding that spiritual dimension really makes us see why Delgado thought this was so important, and helps us understand the kind of full complexity of what these missionaries were trying to justify to themselves and to others at the time. So, yeah, I think that's another example.
Right, for one of those emotions that actually becomes quite an embarrassment, or certainly something that needs to be explained later. This is not the ideal emotion that one would hope a holy man was feeling. So the politics of empire is, of course, never absent, and you've alluded to it throughout our conversation. We're talking about the history of missionization and colonialism, of course. So what are some of the ways that the political is foregrounded in these essays?
Well, I think we all do it in quite different ways. I have to say that there is one exception. I mean, most of these chapters do take place in what we would think of as, classic New World colonial situations. And, of course, Monique Shear's chapter is a bit different in that way, in that it's looking at her German-American missionaries back to Germany. So it's almost like a return from empire, reverse mission, but a very early version of that. But still, of course, the political structures are playing a very, very important part, and that sense of an unequal dynamic between the metropolitan centre and the colonial periphery, and then within the colonial periphery, a sort of unequal dynamic between colonisers and colonised. So I think in terms of that power dynamic, it really was so different in so many of these contexts that I think what we do best in terms of describing that the dynamic is really to do with the specificities, because if you're looking at very early colonial situations, as I do in my chapter on Greenland in Australia, this is a situation where authority is not entirely established yet, and there's more room for negotiation. If you're looking at situations which are more developed, perhaps Maria Cecilia Holt's chapter is one of these, where the Spanish have already been in the Philippines for some time before Delgado makes his intervention to attempt to sort of rehabilitate San Agustin. They're quite different situations. And, of course, the three chapters in the final section on missionary literature and missionary supporters are very interesting, because they're all looking at a later period where really power dynamics have become much more entrenched, and mission is a much more kind of global and almost business-like concern. We have large mission societies sending out large numbers of missionaries and producing large volumes of publications. And so, what the sense you get through those publications is that there are much more rigid power structures, which, of course, was not necessarily the case on the ground. But you certainly can say that with time, these political structures often did become more entrenched, and missionaries had learned to work out their relationships to the colonial state in different ways. But often, certainly in the case of Australia, for example, these links became ever firmer as the colonial state became more and more interested in controlling the movement of Aboriginal people. And so it does really depend on context, but I would say that there's a big difference as well between these early, more fluid sort of colonial settings and what happens later in the sort of late 19th century especially.
Given the wide range of essays, both historically, as we've just been talking about, but also in terms of the places, but as you said, there is something that draws together these evangelical, small e, evangelical Christians who are going out into these mission situations. So what are the main themes of the volume? What ideas do you want readers to take away from this volume of essays?
That's a great question. I mean, I'll fall back to begin with on the structure of the book, which is it's structured into three different sections. And the first is on emotional practices. And I think the three chapters that we have there, which is a really fantastic chapter by Laura Stevens on prayer, which I haven't mentioned yet, but Monique Shear's chapter on shouting, and then Daniel Medina's chapter on feeling for the other, in his case, feeling for Papuans, German missionaries kind of attempting to feel themselves into Papua New Guinean music and therefore sort of also emotional states. I think they really, taken together, helped me to kind of understand what Monique Shear was talking about. I mean, her first article on emotional practices is a classic, but you know, really elaborating this idea of the different ways in which people over time sort of build up emotional practices that come to influence their emotional lives, which come to define and inflect the ways that they interact with God, with each other, with converts. So this idea that emotions are something that we do and that we do over time and that build up resonance over time. And the second section, which is on relationships, I guess refers back to the point I made at the beginning of the interview about just how emotions can help us to understand interactions between missionaries and converts in a much more nuanced way. And often I think these articles suggest that they really give a sense of not necessarily equal agency, but contested agency and you know, power moving between individuals in a much more fluid way than perhaps was happening on a political level. But that the people, in fact, did often have the power to refuse or negotiate or manage or offer emotions in these situations. And they help us to kind of complicate our ideas of what colonial missions might have been like. And then the last section, again, on literature and especially looking at mission supporters and the relationship between mission supporters, missionaries, and then, of course, often the idea of the convert, because, of course, many mission supporters only ever met converts or prospective converts through these texts. I think it both sort of supports literature, which previously has really shown quite a sort of rigidity and often a racial rigidity in the way that missionaries portrayed converts and prospective converts in their publications. And Jane Haggis and Margaret Allen's 2008 article on imperial emotions is wonderful in the way that it opens up questions about how these publications worked in terms of emotions. But I think what those three chapters at the end of the book also do is to sort of complicate the idea of that, in fact, some missionary supporters were also participants in mission, that the boundaries were more fluid. And Hugh Morrison's chapter on children as mission supporters and participants, I think, really complicates that in a lovely way and also brings up the question of family and how the metaphor of family was used by missionaries, by mission supporters, sometimes, you know, by converts themselves, in order to demarcate lines of belonging to include, to exclude, and the just the sort of metaphor of the family of God and the family of man, and the two metaphors, I should say, and the ways in which they interacted, sometimes in sort of concert and other times in tension with each other. So I guess those three kind of strains, I think, were three things that came out for me really strongly of looking at the group of chapters as a whole. And I mean, of course, their gender, you know, crops up a lot there in Angerad Ayer's article on the sacrificial female missionary and the sacrificial native convert, and then that interesting kind of interplay between those two stereotypes or archetypes, I should say, in missionary literature is fantastic, a fantastic look at gender in the role of gender in mission history.
This is a rich field of study, of course. We've just managed to while away an hour talking about it. What are you working on now? More on emotion and missions, or is there something else that you're doing?
Oh, yes, I am actually doing something else now. I still am very interested in emotions, and I'm still working on the large project, which is a comparative project of Greenland and Australia, and looking in particular on the emotional economies of early missions to those two colonies. But I've, the last 6 months or so, been working on two special journal issues, one for the Journal of Social History and one for Social Sciences and Missions. And these both come out of a conference that I held in April in Copenhagen, which was called Colonial Christian Missions and Their Legacies. So through my work on missions, but also the places that I've visited in pursuit of my research, and specifically spending a month in Greenland 2 years ago, I really have become more and more interested in the contemporary legacies of these missions, which, you know, I mean, often mission is ongoing, but you can also then often trace sort of specific political, cultural, social, educational, I mean, really all sorts of different strains in the histories of contemporary countries, whether they're sort of post-colonies or whether they're still continuing settler colonies, such as, for example, Australia, Canada, and just the impact that missions had. And I think it's an impact that is often overlooked, and especially in Australia, where we don't like to we for a long time haven't acknowledged the importance of religion in our history, because we weren't founded as a religious colony, and we don't like to think of ourselves always as particularly religious people. But in fact, the influence of religion has been very great here. But I think all over the world, I mean, especially in places where often colonial power was quite brutal and quite forceful, and often the sort of the legacies of colonialism are seen in terms of secular authorities. But I became really interested in, well, what happens when we look at the specific legacies of missionaries, and they're often to do with education, of course, religious practice, health, but all sorts of other more complex things too, identity, sort of emotional practice even. So I put on this big conference with speakers from 18 different countries. There were 55 of us in total, and that was supported by the Danish Research Council, which was just wonderful. And then I've got 16 articles that have come out of that conference, which I'm putting together in these two different collections, and that's really good fun. I'm learning an awful lot about these very diverse contexts, and also sort of a contemporary perspective on, I guess, what I've been studying for a long time and enjoyed studying in the 18th or 19th century. But of course, I'm fascinated as to what happens to these histories, how they're taken up or discarded, how they're remembered or forgotten, memorialized, or, you know, sort of disparaged in contemporary, as I say, either post-colonies or continuing colonies.
Well, thank you, Claire, for getting us to think in ways that are both comparative and wide-ranging chronologically as well. And those sound like exciting projects, and hopefully people listening to this podcast will pick them up. So thank you very much.